You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's lunchtime talk, focusing on why innovation fails. I'm particularly excited about this talk because innovation is core to my remit here at the RSA. And it runs through as a sort of golden thread through all of our projects and activities that we do, whether it's looking through the lens of the self-employed entrepreneur or at the impacts of artificial intelligence on broader society and the economy. So I'm really excited and keen to hear more about what Frederick and Bjorn can tell me about why it fails and why capitalism may have lost its mojo, as they say in the book, as the catalyst for innovation, by falling into the traps of overzealous corporate managerialism or a reliance on the heroism of the single entrepreneur. So now it's my very great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speakers, Frederick Eriksson and Bjorn Wiegel. Frederick is the director of the European Centre for International Political Economy, a world economy think tank based in Brussels that he co-founded in 2006. He is also an economist and a writer. Bjorn is a business strategist, investor and entrepreneur. He has experience in growing innovative companies and startups. And together they've written a book called The Innovation Illusion, which you'll find in the foyer after you leave. And they both join us today to constructively question the idea that America and Europe is on the threshold of an innovation boom leading to economic growth. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Frederick and Bjorn.
Thank you very much for having us. My name is Bjorn Wiegel. I am the co-author of The Innovation Illusion, together with my good friend, Frederick Eriksson. And just right off the bat, to set the stage here, we love innovations. We think it's the best thing ever. And we spent a lot of time writing this book to make sure that innovations have an easier path getting to all of us. We say that, in fact, we have too little information, not too much. In the world, and we take it even further than that. We think that we are standing or facing a threat, an imminent threat of innovation famine and not an innovation feast that many is contemplating today with robotics and artificial intelligence and so on. Now, why do we say that? We say that because innovation is much, much more than just inventions. Innovations need to strive in an economic system. And in the economic system we're talking about in the Western world today is, of course, capitalism. And capitalism, according to Joseph Schumpeter, is the innovative process of capitalism is a perennial gale of creative destruction. It's a perpetual process in where you have space for economic experimentation, entrepreneurship, and fast adaptation of new inventions. It forces businesses, investors, labor, and government to change, to adapt, to improve, to do something better. But capitalism is more than that. Big innovation is all about allowing and embracing uncertainty, unpredictability, and contestability. And uncertainty especially is something that we have a problem with today because it is in the uncertain environment we usually find the big innovations. But West is nothing like that today. We have been very much addicted to predictability, certainty, and control. There's no room for unpredictability, contestability, or fast adaptation. So the question is, what has happened to capitalism? Why are we in this position? And we conclude in our book that, not to be too overdramatic, but four horsemen of capitalist stagnation rode into Corporateville and actually trashed the place. First is corporate ownership that completely changed. Globalization, second one. Third one is regulations. And fourth one is corporate managerialism. And today, we're going to give you a short introduction to those four and, of course, then go back in when we enter into questions. So the first one, capitalism. Oh, capitalism is a system for ownership. And the key player in capitalism is the capitalist. But over the last 50 years, we removed the capitalist from the equation and introduced institutions. So today, mostly institutions own, govern, and steer our companies and those that are supposed to invent, and innovate and give us all those new perfectly lovable gadgets that we all like. Secondly, we moved from investing in companies or in the real economy and the industry, as we say here, into finance. So the financial economy has been doing very well over the last 20, 30 years. And just to give you an example, for every real industrial dollar or GDP or pound, if you wish, there's 10 financial dollars resting on that sole pound. So it gives you an idea of where our priorities rest. We have ownership has gone from investing in new innovations to saving for pensions. And the change is quite dramatic. And we don't have to go back especially far to get an idea of how tremendous that change has been. When the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck introduced somewhat like the modern pension system in Europe, he was called a socialist because he decided that if you manage to be 70 years or older, perhaps you can get a small pension. At the time, the average life expectancy in Germany was around 40 years. So that was not a daring proposition. Today in Germany, you live until you're 81, 82, and you retire at the age of 61 or 62. And we expect a lot from our pensions. So we are forced to look into and cater for the pensions and the savings around pensions. And it affects the whole economic system that we live in. In fact, many of the pensions organizations and investment funds today facing low rents, as we have been doing for many years, are getting increasingly nervous because if the yields are not picking up anytime soon, they're going to run into big problems, many of them. So ownership changed, and it became grey. So we're talking about grey capitalism and grey capitalist ownership in the book. And we, going into companies, we see what really happens when ownership turns grey. We tend to move away from uncertainty and focus only on risk. That is, anything we cannot quantify into a risk in a company today is something we stay away from. And again, coming back to why is that important? It is when something is uncertain. That is usually where the big innovations hide. Uncertainty you cannot define as risks. So here we see the problem. We have removed the entrepreneur and entrepreneurship from companies. And instead, we have bureaucrats running according to a planning schedule. Entrepreneurs is key for a successful, innovative society. And we have gone from contesting markets into planning for change. So we think that we can take all of the uncertainties and peculiarities about the future, put them into a little Excel sheet, and then just run with it. And life will be very, very predictable, and everything is going to be perfectly fine. And no one will get hurt. Life doesn't work like that. So we have three numbers in front of us here, just to explain a little bit what has happened to corporations and why they are, and what is basically the outcome of a corporate culture that we call corporate managerialism. The first one is 7%. Now 7% is, according to studies from BCG, how much bureaucratization has increased in companies every year for the last 5 decades. Gives you, think of it, it's quite an extraordinary number. The second one is how many goals an average CEO of a big company is handed from the board to steer the company towards. And it has gone up tremendously over the last 40 to 50 years. And think of it, I mean, if you're to do something, have an important task to do, and you set yourself 40 different goals, it's just no way. I mean, many of these goals that the companies are given today, they're absolutely contradictory. It's impossible to actually strive for something today unless you take that number down quite significantly, and we're not doing that. 75%, according to one study, is an example of American CFOs, chief financial officers, said that they would prefer to destroy economic value in a company if the company was perceived to be more predictable coming report times. And this is quite extraordinary. We have capitalism today is is a bureaucratic planning machine in where we, all of us, view companies from the fact that if we are plannable or not, not if we create value.
All right, so it's time for me to take over. Let me also say hello to everyone and thanks to the RSA for hosting us. So Bjorn has now been talking about the two factors in the book that we are using to explain why we think that we have lost a lot of energy and dynamism in that system that we call capitalism. Bjorn talked about the changes in ownership and changes in corporate mentalities, or basically how corporates operate and think about the future, the market, and where they are today. The third factor, which of course goes into explaining a lot about what happened inside corporation, is about globalization and the fact that globalization has probably been the number one big structural change in all economic life for the past 30, 40 years. I think globalization has been great. It's been great in the sense that it has helped to move low productive entities like corporations or even countries to the frontier of productivity and innovation. So we've had trade investment, people moving across borders that has converged a lot of economic actors to the frontier. They are performing far better today than they did in the past. That's the beauty of globalization. Now, globalization has also had a couple of side effects as a consequence of a world where we're competing more globally. And these side effects haven't necessarily been sort of linear type of developments that sort of came straight on the back of new openings for trade or new openings for investment in countries like China or India or elsewhere. What we particularly have seen over the past 20 years is that market concentration in the world has gone up. We're going through a couple of indicators of market concentration in the book, and we're trying to make the point that sort of if you go back sort of 30, 40 years in time and pick any type of sector you like, you count the number of actors that were trying to compete, innovate in that sector then, and you count the number today. And you're probably going to see that the number of actors, the number of entities that are trying to fight for your money are fewer than they were in the past. This doesn't mean that there is no competition, it's just that sort of the competition has changed and we have more market concentration today than we had in the past. Big companies have become bigger and they have become more powerful in the sense that they are much better at controlling markets and controlling development of markets than they were in the past. And this is something I think have been a direct consequence of what we're calling the second wave of globalization, which is the way when huge companies began to slice up the supply and value chains. So if you take, for instance, my phone on the table there, typical iPhone, and you look at the production structure of it, you're going to see that it's going to contain components that totally has crossed borders more than 2,000 times before it was assembled into one particular product that I wanted to buy. And Apple, who is the manufacturer, or at least the company who labels that phone and calls it an Apple iPhone, is not responsible for most of these components. It's other companies that are producing them. But what Apple is skilled at is, of course, is to be at the top of that supply chain and control how it works and position themselves close to their end customers, using a lot of other instruments like sort of brand, corporate loyalties, and stuff like that in order to build a type of competition which isn't so open to the type of contestabilities that we want to see in markets. Tough life and death competition where companies are fighting for their survival. We're, of course, seeing examples of that in different sectors, but as a general trend, we're seeing less of it today than in the past. And this has largely led to sort of a development where a lot of corporations in the world using opportunities from a fragmented, globalized production structure in the world to reallocate where they concentrate the resources. So they don't spend a lot of time sort of in, you know, looking at components production or looking at how to innovate in specific components that may be important for the end product. They concentrate on trying to control the end customer market because that's where the margins are and that's how they sort of can earn a lot of money without being faced with more competition. A last thing about globalization, which of course is also something tremendously good, is specialization. Globalization has helped us to specialize. And for those of you who have sort of learned economics through classical economists like Adam Smith, you will know that specialization is a very strong force for economic growth, for human economic growth as well as for societal economic growth. So specialization is something which is generally very good. But patterns of specialization can also turn into obstacles for fast change for markets. They can make us as individuals to become less open to change because we may have specialized in a way which forces us to try to protect that specialization. And this is very strong among individuals. I mean, think about most of yourselves. You probably have an education. You've probably gone to universities. You have progressively expanded on your own human capital, specialize that human capital to the degree where you can sort of generate more economic value for every input of labor that you put in. So that's highly natural. I mean, that's what we all have been doing. So imagine then that someone comes to threaten that particular pattern of specialization you have. So if you are a medical doctor that have spent perhaps totally 11, 12 years in getting specialized medical education, and some sort of suddenly someone comes up with sort of a smart robot who says, look, this robot can do exactly what you're doing for a fraction of the total cost you have. And what we're seeing then is increasing resistance through specialized individuals, specialized companies, specialized regions, or specialized countries to try to resist that change, or at least try to slow it down. So patterns of specialization can sometimes be turned into what you can call a sunk cost. It's a cost that we've taken, and since we need to try to reap the benefits of it because we can't get the money back, we're trying to protect that investment that we've done. So that's the story of globalization that we're talking about in the book and how it has interfered with corporate strategies and the openness in the economy to fast adaptation to new inventions that are getting out on the market. The last thing we're talking about in the book, the fourth factor, regulation and how regulation has changed with the consequence of affecting the pattern and the pace of innovation. We're not trying to make sort of a case against more or less innovation. We're actually trying to make a case for regulation that is simple, not complex. The more complex the world has become, the more complex many regulators have made regulation. And this is one of the problems that we're facing across the Western world today, that to start with, on many occasions, it's just very difficult to understand what on earth does this regulation mean? What sort of behavior is it instructing individuals, corporates, or others to act upon? Regulations are sometimes highly ambiguous. Regulations are sometimes contradictory. Sometimes we sort of portray a lot of instances in the book where in order to comply with one regulation, you have to break another regulation. So the accumulation of complex regulation has created sort of a landscape of regulation that is deterring for people that want to sort of swim against the stream. People, innovators, companies that want to do something which is different and may have consequences for the instructed regulatory behavior. So what we're trying to say in the book is that when we have had this regulatory development, making the entire regulatory landscape much more sort of complicated to understand, it has forced a lot of innovators, entrepreneurs, and even big companies to reallocate resources from bold, big, radical innovation to safe innovation, incremental innovation, innovation that you know, broadly speaking, is going to be in compliance with the regulations that exist. When we're talking about many things, sort of the bold things today, like AI, like nanotechnology, many, many other things, we're talking about different type of inventions and scientific breakthroughs that require a lot of new regulation. And if new regulation is required in order for an investor or company to put a lot of cash and money into an innovative project, they're going to be deterred. They're going to be confronted with reality where there are huge risks that the investment that you're making may actually just become zero valued because at the end of the process, regulators may not be amenable to the product that you're trying to create. So this pattern of sort of reallocation has been very strong inside large corporations, sort of how they stay away from the big, bold, breakthrough innovations that we like and go for the safe and incremental part. And we are tracking a development which has been taking place over many, many decades. Nothing of this is new. It's not something that has come up recently. We actually go back to sort of the 1960s, 1970s in the book. You're going to find many different charts in order to see the development that we are showing, how corporates have lowered the share of long-term investments as part of their revenues, how they spend a smaller part of their revenues on R&D, how R&D budgets have changed to become more about product adaptation to different markets rather than sort of the old Xerox, Palo Alto research institutes that we knew from the past that was doing a lot of different things. One of the graphs I like myself the most is this one, and we go through one, we have graphs for the UK and other countries as well, where we're trying to show that something fundamentally has changed in capitalism, and it is that the corporate sector today has, for a pretty long time, become a net contributor of money to the rest of the society. The entire idea of capitalism, as you probably will recognize, is that you have an entrepreneur, you have an investor who take up money from the rest of the society, from savers, because they have an idea how to turn that capital into more economic value and into a good yield. And that's how, broadly speaking, the capitalist economy has worked ever since the 19th century when it first emerged, that we've had the rest of the society being a net contributor of money, of capital, to the corporate sector. Now we've had a period of more than 15 years when the corporate sector is becoming like a bank. It's lending money to the rest of the economy. It's not taking up, on net terms, money from the rest of the economy in order to invest in companies. And it has accelerated, of course, after the global financial crisis in 2008, when we have seen now a lot of companies, they are hoarding cash, they are also borrowing a lot of money at zero rates, but they're not using it to invest. They're using it for other purposes. Usually they're using it for defensive purposes, like sort of doing mergers and acquisitions and behave in other ways in order to consolidate markets and make markets less open to strong competition. The point here is basically that there is something which has changed in the behavior of capitalism, and it's that change of behavior which has made us, or made the capitalism, to lose its mojo and to become a very defensive, hidebound, even dull economic system that don't foster that go-getting, disruptive, innovative spirit that we like to see. Thank you.
Couldn't you tell us what mojo means?
We'll do an exploration into mojo, shall we? That's a, I'll try and weave that into my first question. Thank you very much for that presentation. When reading your book, it did feel like a bit of a lament to one's youth. So a sort of a baby boomer entrepreneur, thinking back about when I was once creative and now I'm no one's creative anymore. You know, actually thinking about the 60s and 70s and 80s is a very productive time and fertile, innovative time. And now you describe it as, you know, capitalism has become middle-aged and sick. I think you referred to Tyler Cohen's, we ate all the low-hanging fruit and got sick. So that kind of gorging on I'm going to go wild with euphemisms, but cash cow steak, you know, really getting to that point of, really, we've done all of the efficiency innovation we can do, and business has now lost its mojo. So let's think about what mojo is. It's spark, it's creative potential, it's excitement, it's new ideas. I think novelty is where we're looking again. So I guess the question is, you know, you've outlined here some of the key differences between a capitalist and a rent seeker, but how can that value creator, that bold innovator return? How do we regain capitalism's mojo?
Well, the first step, I think, is to recognize that we have a problem. And that's where we started with the book, is that we had this idea of how things worked, and we discussed it with people, and we tend to get the same answer, and that was, we are living in the most of innovative times. How can this be? So first step, just, okay, recognize the problem, and then we can perhaps get into getting back to one thing that I think in your excellent introduction there to mojo is what we think we should perhaps highlight a little bit. We need to get curiosity back. We're not curious for what we can do. And when I was a child, we're the same age, there was a lot of curiosity around about space, new explorations, what we could do as humans. Today, we're mostly afraid of robots and artificial intelligence and afraid of our jobs and afraid of all of that. And we don't think of all the things we actually could do.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to sort of fundamental thing that you pointed to, which is we're talking about sort of that the type of capitalism which has emerged over the past 70 years is a rentier type of capitalism, not sort of rentier type of capitalism a la the 19th centuries that you can read about sort of in good old British novels by Henry James and others, not sort of a classic Marxist type of rentier capitalism in the sense that you practice ushery and you have sort of huge inequalities between different people, and different classes that arise. It's a rentier capitalism which is based on highly rational behavior. I practice it myself because I save money. I try to save for myself, for my future retirement. I try to save for my kids. I try to sort of make sure that financially, when I leave this world, my kids are sort of going to be pretty okay. I go into different funds and ask them to give me a professional service. I'm not good at sort of investing money. That's not what I've done in my past. If I were going to do it, I'm probably going to bet all my money on one company, and then sort of all my investment was just, you know, become obliterated in a few years' time. So I need that professional service. I go to an investment institutions. And these investment institutions become larger, 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 and larger. And they look at me and they ask sort of, so what type of investment are you looking at? Do you want us sort of to bet all this money on future sort of space explorations that sort of AI will change the sort of the nature of humanity and sort of we're all going to turn into CMI robots in the future? And I said, no, I want something much more predictable. Give me 8% every year, I'm going to be happy. If sort of now, perhaps, give me 5% every year, and I'm going to be happy as well. Well, give me 100%, I'm going to be happy these days. So sort of through that rational process, we get all those investment institutions that make investments into companies. They're becoming the dominant shareholders in company, and they tell the management, the only thing we want is sort of that predictability. We don't want you really to be that bold, aggressive. The only thing we want you to do is deliver in accordance with the formula that our savers have. And unless we can change that, I think we are going to move even more into this sort of type of rentier type of capitalism, that at the end of the day, we all own these companies, but we really have no business idea what these companies should do.
But you're part of the problem there.
I am.
You know? I mean, that's an interesting one. I had a conversation with my pension provider, and he said, Would you like the ethical fund? It's more risky. Uh-huh. Is it now? Shall we have a chat about that? And we had a lovely hour-long conversation. But that's very interesting. I mean, that fear runs through both of those answers. And there's something that you bring, you know, there's a couple of oxymorons that come out in the book. You know, you talked earlier in the presentation around globalization is great. But you also say something really, really striking in the book. You say, reversing capitalism's decline is pivotal to stopping populist unrest in the West. And we spoke earlier, you said, what Donald Trump is really saying is someone stole my American dream. And I'd like to investigate that a bit more. You know, if we're getting some really strong populist signals around the world that feel like they're resisting new ideas, how do you address that fear factor? How do we stand strong and bold to embrace new innovation while at the same time facing a tsunami back that says stop?
It's strange to get that question now. I don't know why. I mean, we get back to this all the time talking to people now, especially after the presidential election, of course. First of all, if we don't, the problem is just going to escalate. And again, I'm coming back to this. We need to try to see the state of the world as it is right now. I think that a lot of people are afraid of new technology, of innovations, of robotics and artificial intelligence. Perhaps they shouldn't be. Perhaps there's a completely different story. And if they saw that, perhaps they should see things a little differently. The question you're asking is rather big, actually. How to sort this humongous question out. But it starts with an appreciation of what actually got us as a Western world to where we are today. Why were we so successful for so many years? And if people understood that we're actually losing it, the very thing that actually gave us all the good things we have today, perhaps we will see a rather big change in the perception of reality. And again, you could come back to the importance of an open society and all of those issues that we cherish. But it starts with a fair understanding. And I'm not going to go into a comment on any election, Brexit or the Trump or the present election, but it's striking that you can have so many election cycles, and I say this has been going on for many years in the Western world, where you actually don't discuss any of the fundamentally important issues of economic growth and development and progress. You discuss a lot of other things, but you fail to get into this issue and in effect, perhaps enlighten people.
Okay. I'm going to come to the audience for some questions, so please put your hands up so I can see them and ask one more question before we do that. A stream of the work that we do at the RSA is looking at the single entrepreneur or small enterprise and how small enterprise can influence innovation in society. Something that comes out of your book is actually the slightly corrosive relationship that can be held between big corporations or funders or institutions with smaller enterprise. So actually the contracting of innovation or the funding of innovation or the investing innovation is too tight. So I'm interested in how, you know, as you illustrate that there's a kind of almost a whole reliance of small enterprise on corporations and those contracts. How do you break that cycle and allow or foster risk in the funder, the investor, or the corporation to those smaller enterprises or those entrepreneurs to really allow for that fertile territory for innovation?
I think there are many things that can be done. And I think the problem we're trying to talk about in the book is not that we're having a problem with input, in the sense we don't having a problem with that there's too little new technology that is coming, there's too few scientific breakthroughs, or that sort of, like some people are saying, sort of that, well, you know, we have invented all things that are worth inventing, and now sort of we have to look towards a future where technology simply isn't going to play that role for our societies anymore, because sort of we have the automobile, we have electricity, we have sort of, we can fly from London to wherever in the world in sort of a short distance of time, etc. We're trying to tell a different story, which is that there is a lot of
exciting things that are there. But it's just that process of allowing space for it, allowing for experimentation in the economy. That's sort of where you have the process of innovation today. So we have a problem with output, not input. And that's, to me, that is good news. That is an optimistic view of the world, because if we really had a problem with sort of not having any new exciting ideas anymore and not having new exciting technologies anymore, then we really would be in an enormously difficult situation. But I think we have. So it's far more about making sure that that space is going to be there, that young entrepreneurs, new entrepreneurs, anyone who wants to contest markets will have the space for it. And you can work with policy tools as well as investment products in order to try to go there. There are sort of a role for you as an individual. There's a role for sort of financial institutions, and there is a role for government to try to fix that. But it's possible to fix. It's about sort of making sure that this space for experimentation is going to be there. And that can be a more active use of competition policy. And perhaps what we're trying to outline in the book, change the nature of competition policy. Don't be so afraid of sort of new companies with a great technology sort of taking a big market share for the moment. Look at how contracts in those enormously sophisticated supply and value chains are organized. What about sort of, what if a great innovator for one component which can revolutionize the way we use our smartphones would come up with something that would be directly competitive with Apple? Could they really go into the market with that? Would it really be space for that innovator to go in and compete with Apple? And in many markets, you will find that sort of, you can't. The only thing you can do in terms of generating commercial success for innovation is to step into an existing supply chain, an existing value chain, and avoid competing with the company that reigns at the top of that supply chain. And if you don't do that, if you try to contest it, you're going to find enormously skilled companies that know how to use their incumbency advantages, know how to use their political commercial connections in order to make competition smaller.
If I may just pick up on that, because I work with a lot of small companies aspiring to contest. What I've seen over the last 10 to 15 years is they have less and less come to really go into anything to contest, but to find someone who can actually acquire them. So they have already started to give up, and you can, in many countries, I think, except for Sweden, perhaps, and one other in Europe, you have decline on new entrepreneurship. And the reason for it is that I think people are already seeing the obstacles coming in. If someone comes to me with a great idea or perhaps a great technology, that's usually where the work starts. I mean, if you have the perfect gadget, it's no guarantee for success whatsoever. And people are starting to realize that and understand that if we're going to make our efforts worth, we need to find someone who can buy us. Mm-hmm. So they have already given up to the system and the incumbents, who then decide the pace of innovative change.
Subsuming the innovation. It's interesting, that reminded me of a study that you refer to in there, which says a study shows that almost 60% of iPhone owners admit to blind loyalty to the product. And within that, 28% of Apple's loyal customers do not think of it as the best phone. Only 28% of Apple's loyal customers think of it as the best phone on the market, but they still buy it. So there was a gentleman in the back.
My heart tells me that Frederick and Bjorn are right and that innovation is the way forward. But I see around me a lot of unemployment in Europe between the ages of 21 and 34, up to and beyond 50% of the population have no jobs. I've refused to go to Tesco and mark out my shopping electronically by myself. I always go to a person because they're employed, and I believe in employability. So innovation seems to be taking jobs away. What's your opinion on that?
Future of work.
Yeah, I mean, of course. Innovation that means something to the economy will have knock-on effects on
existing firms, you will see firms going bankrupt, the firms that have to change the product portfolio in order to survive the competition or to sort of just step up and become equally innovative themselves. You're going to find people that sort of lose their employment. And that's something which has been constantly running through the economy for a long period of time, that sort of job creation and job destruction in the economy is strong. What we've seen, however, over now sort of 25 years, is that the job destruction and job creation in the economy is going down. People stay longer at work than they did in the past. People change work less often now than they did in the past. We have sort of less of that dynamism in the economy than we had in the past. So sort of what we're trying to describe in the book is sort of a process where sort of highly innovative societies in the West, they have existed and have existed pretty recently, where many of these attributes of a dynamic economy existed, but that we've been moving away from it for a pretty long period of time now. Now, to the first point you're making, there's a lot of unemployment in the economies these days. I think most people would agree that sort of the lion's share of unemployment that exists today is because of macroeconomic factors. It's not because of technology or innovation. It's because we've had, at least for the past 10 years, a difficult recovery from an economic crisis. Before that, we had sort of a pattern of economic growth which created types of employment and types of economic behavior which simply weren't sustainable. And these things have very little to do with innovation and technology themselves. The type of technological unemployment that economists talk about is actually a very small part of the total employment in most Western economies these days.
Brussels is absorbed totally with the idea of reindustrialization. There's a great accent on going back to basics and tooling and working in a factory-style environment, something that England neglected to do in the time of Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher said, and she had a very good point, that services are the way forward. And let's forget about manufacturing. And then we went back after Margaret Thatcher, realized that the Germans were very good at manufacturing and employed a lot of people. And perhaps we don't.
Okay. Hello, I'm Derek Bates. One of the problems I'm not sure you address in the book, because I haven't read it yet, but is the what you might call the race to the cheapest. We go on to the web, we find something at $10, and there's something next to it at $9, so we go for the $9. I yesterday had a meeting with a man who has been in China. He's an Englishman, been in China for 20 years, and he is going to companies and checking on their quality. And what happens is that a major clothing manufacturer, for instance, goes to a Chinese company with a specification, says, how much can you make it for? The reply is $10. That's not cheap enough. So he gets it for $8. And of course, the specification gets whittled down. So as he says, the sleeves of the shirt are reduced a little bit. He leaves out the good quality buttons and so on. So what I'm saying is this is one problem of globalization, is that competition is acute and it's driving quality down.
So how do we avoid the race to the bottom, I think is a summary of that.
Let's run with the shirt analogy and see how many could afford to buy shirts 100 years ago and how many can afford to buy them today. So there tend to be, and I'm not saying that you are being elitistic, but there is an elitistic element to that argument, which I strongly object to. Because I think that we are providing more and more people with better and better products and services because we have been driving down costs. And And cost is something that you always hunt in any business venture whatsoever. Even in the high quality manufacturers, you try to drive down costs. And it's actually quite beneficial to all of us. And it nothing changed in that fact from today, from previous times, I would say.
What I think is interesting, sort of, when you look at a typical consumer today, is that you have sort of a very split behavior, almost a split consumer personality, in the sense that you sometimes chase sort of down to the last cent different sort of efficiency gains that you can get by sort of buying online rather than going to the store. But then we sort of liberally sprinkle a lot of cash on different other things that where we don't sort of apply that particular mindset. And sort of when you look at economies more broadly and not just from sort of the lens of a particular consumer. So I mean, take a country like America. So was a study that recently came out which showed that from 1970 up to roughly today, the average worker in America had received, in inflation-adjusted terms, a total wage increase of 3% since 1970, in real terms. At the same time, total compensation for the average worker during that period of time had gone up sort of by 65%. And where is that money going? Sort of what the difference between total compensation for the same employer and the salary for it? Well, it's healthcare costs. So we have now sort of a mentality where sort of not, I mean, not necessarily that we're accepting sort of very generous spending on healthcare in the UK and many other countries, but where we accept sort of the efficiency paradigm in one type of consumer behavior, but we don't do it in other parts we have. So I think it's a split different type of direction we're seeing. But I think where I would agree with you sort of is on globalization is that sort of I think it has programmed a lot of businesses to be hunting efficiencies, not exactly structuring companies on the basis of trying to create something new or trying to do something different. They're just trying to do exactly what others are doing. So if you can save some money by going sort of to China to relocate production of that, you're going to do it. And sometimes it's going to lower quality, sometimes it's not going to lower quality. But if we sort of assume that this is the type of economy we've had in the past, I think the interesting question right now is that what's going to happen in the future? Because these type of corporate economy-wide windfall gains, they're not there anymore. I mean, we don't have another 1 billion people in China about to step into the world economy, and we don't have them elsewhere either. So when that windfall is not really sort of giving energy to economies anymore, where should it come from?
The Jeremy Rifkin end of marginal gains. This gentleman here.
Terence Bendixson, University of Southampton. Thanks for a very stimulating pair of talks. Prompts all sorts of thoughts, but just one. And coming back to your smartphone, I got the impression that you're hoping already for a revolution that's going to replace that particular technology. But to choose a historical example, if you look at the book, by about 1850, steam printing and binding and all of that had been sorted out, and books just were churned out physically again and again in a very similar way. But writers changed dramatically. The novel went on evolving and evolving and evolving. Aren't the apps that you've probably got in your phone the evolution in that particular technology, which is going to occupy another 5, 10, 15, 20 years before the technology itself gets replaced?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I think you're right. And that's what makes me a bit sort of pessimistic and dismal. Do I have to be sort of kidnapped by this sort of boring app economy for another 10, 15 years? You know, shall I go out and chase Pokemons sort of 5 years from now as well? Well, not perhaps Pokemons, but something different. And sort of, isn't there going to be anything more inspiring, revolutionary, that sort of is going to take our imagination somewhere else? So, but you're probably right. I mean, sort of, you look at the fluctuations and waves of technology in the past, you see sort of exactly what you said, sort of you know, come up with something like steam engine or a combustion engine, and then you're going to see sort of almost an arc of different product developments and economic behavior that follows on them, and then they begin to peter out, then something new comes. My hope is at least that we can shorten this particular life cycle of technology that we have today and allow for something new and something more exciting to come sooner.
Well, human evolution.
My name is Kevin Spellman. I'm a fellow at the RSA. So thank you both very much for this talk, and thank you very much for chairing it. One question that I guess I do have, there's kind of a generalization that permeates this talk, whether it's the we, and I'm not sure who we is. And there are also comments about finances. One thing that I notice is that the 1% of the world has 99% of the world's wealth. And when you speak about these things, they're quite in general terms. And so I think part of that message gets diluted. The question that I guess I have is, when we make a relationship between innovation, creativity, complexity, and capitalism, is capitalism actually fundamental to innovation? Innovation is an activity, much like creativity. It allows us to work through scenarios and situations. When you categorize it as a technical thing that supplants, say, an iPhone, I become quite worried.
Yeah. First of all, we in the book is the Western world as we define it, as Europe and North America. And much of what we say can relate to other countries as well. We had to narrow it down somehow. I think we still have quite a large gap of bite we try to take on the world. This is extremely important. We as humans, yes, have been inventive for a long, long time. But something changed 250 years ago, and we turned that invention into something else. That was prosperity, economic progress. The reason why we're all sitting in this beautiful room instead of we're sitting in a cave somewhere is that we figured out how to actually drive prosperity. And that, to me, is the core of capitalism. And what is capitalism? It's much a setting free of what you define as this human nature. It wasn't that we were not inventing stuff earlier as well, but we couldn't turn that into economic gains. And there's a lot of discussions going around why and what really happened and how do you define it. But to me, to make it very short and sweet, it's about capitalism. It's that system that created or opened up and made it possible for us to economically gain from what we invented.
I think you also talk about the moral imperative of capitalism as well, yeah. And the actual seeing capitalism as a sort of seat of creativity to be applied to society. So it exemplifies progress, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a big sort of ideological, ideas-based debate about capitalism. It's a word which has sort of a bad rap in some quarters. We're trying to avoid that, and the only thing we're trying to say is basically what we call capitalism is something which emerged in the late 18th century, early 19th century, where you had profound institutional change in society, in politics, in law, in religion, in literature, in philosophy, that created new space for people to behave differently, to behave different from norm, to try to contest different things. And that what you can contest was sort of could be religion, it could be your parents, it can be sort of another company or sort of a privilege-based economic system that existed. But it is that particular sort of attribute, these attributes are, that we mean when we're talking about capitalism. And sort of it goes back to a long series of books that have come out recently from different people that have been trying to sort of define what we mean with capitalism. And we think it's more about sort of its ideas and institutions.
Now, the benefits of having two amazing speakers is that you get very rich answers to your questions, but it also means that we eat up the time more quickly. So we have, unfortunately, come to the end of our hour-long slot in this which is probably the most like a cave room that we have at the RSA. And so I do want to extend my gratitude to Frederik Eriksen and Bjørn Viegel in coming here to talk today about innovation. And I think what Charles Handy described when he came to speak with us about a year ago around the second curve, you know, the next wave, how do we think about a productive economy and productive innovation going forward. So thank you, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.